So the theme is joy, as the church invites us. It's called Gaudete Sunday. And again, the rationale is from an older time in which Lent was more austere. And we wanted to sort of pull back, remind ourselves that both that Christmas is almost here and that that there is a joy in our journey. There's a joy in salvation. I like this idea of joy being, because so what I've done over the years, and I haven't spent this much time with joy, but over the years as I've thought about these great theological doctrines or terms like grace or faith, love, is I've said, what do I mean when I say this word? You know, you sing about it, you repeat it, but what do you actually mean? Most times, and I know I've said stuff like this to you before, but when I say something is hard, you all have an idea of what hard means. You've experienced hard, and difference between hard and soft. There's degrees, sure, but we all are fairly comfortable with these sorts of terms. But grace and faith are way too nebulous. And then when we get God into the equation, we are even outside of what a human experience of grace or faith or love might be. So I've spent time trying to figure this stuff out because I hate just going through the motions or saying meaningless things. It's important that I at least enter into some level of meaning in what I'm saying. It's important for me. And of course, I needed desperately to begin to unlock whatever it was that God said he was going to give me, because it wasn't happening, right? I wasn't getting any traction on that. And so I thought perhaps part of that was my faulty understanding. It was indeed part of the problem. Sorry, can you just bring me down a bit? I'm way too loud to myself, so thank you. That's good. Better. Maybe back up just a hair. Thank you. So joy is this feeling of just the release or the relief. Like, so you're out gardening or something, or changing a tire, or under your car changing oil, and you get up and you're like, oh, wow, does that hurt? And then you're like, you stretch, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, that feels better. And then you do a little jig, right? Like the kid said, that's how they express joy, is they dance. The happy dance. It's a great, so that's a good image for us when we think about joy. Because that's precisely what's happened. Is all of creation, says Paul in Romans chapter 8, groans, waiting for the liberation of the children of God, waiting for the revelation of the children of God. The whole world groans under a burden. Under, we call it the curse, right? Going back to Genesis chapter 3. Because of sin, rebellion against God, futility and frustration, brokenness and hardship came upon the entire planet, all of creation, and upon humans. You can go back and refresh your memory on that wonderful, uplifting little passage about the consequences of that original sin, that first sin. And so joy is when we're visited in this midst of our stooped overness, when the weight of our circumstances bow us down, and that is relief, the release and the relief of that standing up is that essential sort of catalyst or essential kernel of what joy is and what joy means in the Gospels, in the Bible. So we see this picture in Isaiah, this wonderful, like we don't live in a desert, but you can almost imagine it when you're out here walking, you know, out on the prairies and stuff. And just this idea of all of a sudden the desert turning into a verdant pasture with flowers in bloom and springs of water flowing up. Where there used to be dust and heat and dry rocks, there's pools of water and there's reeds and rushes that grow up. And And then, of course, with this is the peace. There's no ravenous beasts that threaten the traveler on the way. So God, in the midst of the desert, prepares a way for his people so that they might return. And they are his ransomed ones. That's the image at the end of this passage. The redeemed ones will walk on it. His ransomed ones will return with joy and great gladness. And the ransom is being bought. That's this image. There's various images, but probably the one that speaks clearest to us is the idea of being a slave at the auction mart, and somebody purchases you in order to set you free. They purchase you, and then they say, you're free now. Your debt has been paid. You're released from any claim. There's no longer bondage, slavery, futility, servitude. You are a free being. Now, we've seen the movies, read the books. We can maybe imagine that. Thank God we don't live in that context. For most of us, that's just an idea, but it is a powerful idea to imagine and to envision being that that one that was owned and without any capacity to work for our own freedom. And that release is joy. You can only just imagine what that would be like after you begun to believe it, right? You're like, oh, you're kidding me, right? What? This is some sort of trick? It's cruel. I get the humor, though. And no, it's true. You're free. And this, more than anything, shows us the heart of God. Because the slave owner doesn't understand themselves needing to be freed and doesn't live with the same level of burden. But the slave, that person who has become an object, a possession, dehumanized, is the one who God comes to visit, to release, and to redeem. And that shows us the heart of God. So Jesus tells John, this is precisely the fulfillment of God's purpose in sending his son, sending the Messiah. John has some doubts. He says, are we supposed to wait for someone else? John has doubts because Jesus' ministry is under the radar. It's really subtle as far as messianic claims are. And Jesus is hanging out with all the wrong people. There's no way to run for political office or to rule a country by hanging out with lepers and deaf people. It's just the wrong strategy. And so John has doubts. And it's important that we remember that John had doubts, because it's important that we remember that though God has acted in Jesus Christ and fulfilled his promises, and that's very clear, for 2,000 years the church has stood solidly on this promise that God has acted in Jesus Christ to fulfill his promises, these great promises in the Old Testament. It's also very clear that the evidence for God's fulfilling his promises in Jesus Christ is not a proof that demands a verdict from others. It never has been, and it never can be. We can always miss it. And so Jesus says, you tell John what you're seeing, and then he says, blessed, happy, fortunate, blessed by God is the one who does not stumble on account of me, who does not take offense on account of me. And this image of taking offense is the one that Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians, that Jesus is that stumbling block, is that offense, is that scandal, both to the religious and to the intellectual. So anyway, it's important that we remember that doubt is always a possibility, and that God does not move in such a way that he blows us out of the water and demands that we recognize him as God. Very rarely does God act that way. Again, God be praised. He doesn't reveal himself in that way. Most of us would Well, I wouldn't continue to exist, I think, if God showed up in that way in my life. So he comes subtly, but he reveals his heart, a heart towards the broken and the needy. And this is precisely the cause for our joy, because I believe this speaks to the deepest part of our spirit, the deepest part of our hunger and our longing. Imagine being a parent who has a sick child or a child who has other sort of issues and problems, even if that child is 45, and how your heart goes out to help, to do something for them, to be the change that they can't be in their own life. How you long to just be poured out so that they might see what they need to see or respond in a way. Right? That's you. You're human. You're broken. You're self-centered and selfish at some level. Sorry, not speaking personally to anybody. And yet you long so deeply to give to those you love. And this is the heart of God. To give to those who need. To be that change that they can't manage to be for themselves. To be that hope in the middle of hopelessness. And that can always be misunderstood. Right? Always be missed. Always be potentially taken advantage of, although God's better at not getting taken advantage of than you and I are. But we know that's a possibility. We know people can abuse love. But God takes that risk. And he gives. And here's where we find our own deepest longing. Because just as we desire that for our children or our grandchildren or our friends and family, our neighbors, desire to give, especially for those who can't help themselves for whatever reason, our own heart longs for the truth of that. We're that needy person. We're that blind person. We're that lame person. We're that person who just can't hear. And Jesus said, this is the good news that's been preached to the poor, that the lame are leaping and the deaf are hearing and the mute are singing. And this is the occasion for joy. Now, I know if that's true, that you've learned not to recognize that, and you've learned to pretend that isn't what's deeply true about you, and you've learned to do other things with that longing, mostly to shut it up, to silence it. And this Advent, I'm inviting you to listen to that again. Just let yourself long for God. Let yourself miss him. Recognize that you're missing him. You long for that truth. Barren places, bearing fruit, being abundant and verdant, pools of water springing up. I love this passage from Frederick Buechner. If you're into sort of edgy, almost agnostic Christianity, Frederick Buechner is your guy. Alphabet of Grace is the name of this book. This is what Buechner says about his own conversion experience. He's a young man in New York City trying to be an aspiring novelist, agnostic, goes around the corner to a nearby church on a Sunday morning for whatever reason. The coronation of Queen Elizabeth has recently happened. The preacher is preaching about coronation as a theme. The preacher says that unlike Elizabeth's coronation in the abbey, this coronation of Jesus in the believer's heart, so Jesus is crowned king in our hearts, the believer's heart, this coronation of Jesus in the believer's heart took place among confession. And I thought, yes, yes, confession. And tears, he said. And I thought, tears, yes. Perfectly plausible that the coronation of Jesus in the believing heart should take place among confession and tears. And then with his head bobbing up and down so that his glasses glittered, he He said in his odd, sandy voice, the voice of an old nurse, that the coronation of Jesus took place among confession and tears, and then, as God was and is my witness, great laughter. He said, Jesus is crowned among confession and tears and great laughter. And at the phrase great laughter, for reasons that I've never satisfactorily understood, the Great Wall of China crumbled and Atlantis rose up out of the sea, and on Madison Avenue at 73rd Street, tears leapt from my eyes as though I had been struck across the face. If our own need and our own longing is a deep sense that we carry with us in life, it's only the absence of a deeper longing, the longing for joy. And I think that's what took Buechner by surprise. As humans, we can manage pain. We've had to. We've learned to make it work, make it okay. But great laughter, joy, that takes us out of ourselves and into the arms of our Savior. Amen.